Congratulations, you have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lambcast. This is episode 715, and I'm your host, Richard Kirkham. 23 years ago, we were introduced to the characters of Rocky and Ginger, two chickens who recreated The Great Escape, and Chicken Run became a beloved film here on the Lambcast. 200 episodes ago, back in 2020, we featured Chicken Run as Movie of the Month. Now those two lovebirds are back in a sequel that features the disturbing question, which eggs hatch and which ones go on somewhere else? Rocky and Ginger have a hatchling named Molly who has some of the same traits that her parents do, basically a reckless pursuit of their own individuality. Will there be a family crisis? Will we get a return of secondary characters? Will there be an impossible mission to accomplish? Well, obviously, duh. Speaking of returning characters, our guest list today includes the champion of the Movie of the Month episode of Chicken Run from a few years ago, from Coogs Reviews and our own director series, Tony Coogan. Welcome, Tony.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back on for this one.
Yes, of course. Also back from that earlier episode, the former head rooster of the Lambcast, now deeply embedded in the ocean with sharks rather than poultry, Jay Cluett.
I am guest number 3 of 5. Why 5? Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. A real trooper back for the third week in a row, willing to put up with our shenanigans. That shows a high level of commitment to our community. Bring her own bucket with her, Rachel Wagner.
I'm happy to be here.
And finally, rounding out the show because Colonel Sanders was not available, from blogging by Cinemalite, James Wilson.
But I don't want to join the fray.
We made him join the fray anyway. I'm afraid you're going to have to talk to us. All right, well, as IMDb puts it, having pulled off a death-defying escape from Tweety's farm, Ginger has finally found her dream, a peaceful island sanctuary for the whole flock, far from the dangers of the human world. When she and Rocky hatch a little girl named Molly, Ginger's happy ending seems complete. But back on the mainland, the whole of chicken kind faces a new and terrible threat. For Ginger and her team, even if it means putting their own hard-won freedom at risk, this time they're breaking in and not out. Okay, everyone, it's go time. I set
it
up.
And there was much science.
And you guys are supposed to follow up.
too obvious.
Okay, never mind. Let's start with our first impressions. And remember, we're going to stay spoiler-free for a little bit. So, Jay, let's start with you. What did you think of the film?
Okay, so as we've discussed on 200 episodes ago, which feels like a ridiculously long amount of time, love Chicken Run, saw it in the cinema on a kid's birthday party. I was one of those kids. Have always loved it ever since. So I think it might have been the first Aardman film I saw. So was looking forward to this one. Disappointed it didn't open near me in the cinema. I think it was like at a good hour away. So naturally, that's how I saw it. And let's just say, so we were going to get a takeaway that evening. We'd have a place near us that does a really good chicken burger. But I thought we probably shouldn't order that the day we're going to watch Chicken Run Dawn of the Nuggets. So we didn't. I made a pizza. It's fine. The next day, we had no qualms about ordering that chicken burger. It's fine. It's not as good as the first one. It was never going to be as good as the first one when you have the nostalgia on it. I think the recast actors do a pretty good job. I watched this with my wife. She, other than Tony, she's the only person I know who likes Chicken Run more than I do. And about exactly 70 seconds into the film, we paused it and she's like, is that? That's Zachary Levi. Like, they couldn't get Mel Gibson back? And I had to explain why they didn't want to have Mel Gibson back. And she hadn't heard of the sugar tits of it all. So I got to explain that whole thing. and when he was cast as Mark Wahlberg's dad in Daddy's Home 2, that was actually really good casting. I had to explain all of that. But I think that all the recast members did a good job. I think Bella Ramsey is great as Molly. I just think that the overall story and the set pieces don't hold up as well as 23 years of solid nostalgia. But that's not the film's fault. That's more mine, I guess. Kids seeing it these days might love it. But I thought, I'm glad I watched it. I'm not sure when I'll see it again.
Well, that seems reasonable. You know, everybody's going to have a different opinion on something. And this is, like you said, it's a nostalgia thing for you because you're coming back to it. Maybe it'll be fresh for all the kids who haven't been loving Chicken Run for the last 20 years. Speaking of loving Chicken Run, I know that Tony's a big fan, and he was very high on this particular movie. This movie, by the way, was chosen by the community over the other big film that was opening this weekend, Wonka. So we are not talking about Wonka. We're talking about Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget. And one of the reasons I'm sure that's true is because Tony Coogan, I'm sure, voted for Chicken Run. So, Tony, what did you think of the movie?
Yeah, well, something like Jay, I'm a massive fan of Chicken Run. I championed it to be Movie of the World several years ago now. It was a foundational film for me growing up. It's one of the films that has made me the film fan I am today. And so when this sequel was announced, I was really excited to see it. So I was initially thrown off by the recastings, and some of them I wasn't quite sure about when they were announced, like so knowing him off as stand-up comedian being the Tree Wizard, seeing Ramesh Ranganathan had been cast in it and replacing him with Small, that was the big one that threw me. But I was willing to give everyone the chance. And this is also one where I actually first saw it just over 2 months ago as part of the this year's London Film Festival. So I saw it. I'm not going to say exactly in the first public screening of it. There's like one of the first. Sorry, on the day of its premiere, I'll say. Actually, at the Watershed Cinema in Bristol, about 15 minutes walk away from Aardman HQ. And when I'm in the audience, and definitely when I was sitting through the credits, you could tell there were quite a few members of Aardman's staff who'd worked on the film in the audience. Waiting for the credits, excited they're not seeing their names in there. So that was a good bit of fun to see stuff like that. And the film itself, I mean, even I know it's not as good as the first one. It was never for me never going to be as good as the first one. But I still had a great time with it. I had a lot of fun with it. I was able to get used to most of the recasts fairly quickly. Like, the returning cast was still solid. They did a great job. And like, I like the set piece, like the different style, going for more like a 1960s spy aesthetic rather than the like Great Escape feel of the first one. It gave it like a bit of a unique sounds compared to it. And this is just a bit, I still love like this style that Aardman has, this unique, quirky stop motion feel that they do, and I'm always a sucker for it. And yeah, I just ended up having a really great time with it, and watching it again last night prior to recording this episode. Yeah, I still had a lot of fun with it. So, again, I don't think it's as good as the first one, but I still have a lot of fun with this.
That's fine. I'm beginning to sense a theme here. It's not going to be compared as favorably to the first one as we might hope and would want, but not necessarily with disdain. Well, let me see. I don't want to jump in too quickly. I do know that some people are less than enthusiastic about it. Let's hear from Rachel, who found it to be, what would you say, okay?
Yeah, I probably will go fresh on it. I haven't written my review yet, but it kind of was one of those movies. It was perfectly pleasant. Like, there was nothing like bad about it, but it was very forgettable, which I don't know, seems like almost the, is that even the worst? Is it worse to be forgettable or to be memorably bad? I don't know.
Well, I know that some memorably bad films are still lurking in my head, and plenty of forgettable films, of course. They're called forgettable because you don't remember them at all.
Yeah.
You know,
I'll take a memorably bad film any day of the week over something like that.
At least a bad film that's memorably bad, you at least remember something about it.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about coming on this podcast, and I'm like, I don't know if I have anything to say. Like, it was fine. Like, it was perfectly serviceable, but that's about all I got.
Well, fair enough. James, you're going to be tipping the balance a little bit. How are we going with this?
I find the collective disdain very troubling. I think you guys have no soul. I've loved the Aardman Animation Group since Creature Comforts, their little short from many, many years ago. And the one thing that I've always loved about these films is the fact that they have they do these things one frame at a time and so meticulously, but given the amount of workload, they still manage to have this sense of new and surprising things that really are funny and just have these wonderful little grace notes throughout. And when I was watching this, I kept noticing the little details of expression, the way when someone blinks, they always have to blink three times, not two, not once, has to be three. And there's a nostalgia factor here that can't be crossed, but seeing what they do with it now, I'm always amazed at how they up their game from film to film. It's like Pixar. There are always some sort of quantum leap of technology and artistry that they achieve beyond what the first one does. Yes, this one might be a little too long and a little too complicated. But man, it's one of those films that causes synaptic anarchy in my brain and makes me fall asleep. And that's not a bad thing. I've fallen asleep through a couple of films of Terry Gilliam just because the thing was so awash with detail and so just so full that my brain just shuts down. And I found myself doing that with this film. I think that's a good thing. And it makes me want to watch it again once I've woken up. I really like this film. Sure, it may not be as fresh as the first one, but it's not a complete bad egg, so I wouldn't toss it into the bin. But I really enjoyed myself and just thought it was a wonderful thing to behold while it was going on. Some of the, I know Chicken Run really well because it was when I was teaching a post-production class. It was one of the films that the students had to strip the sound out of and recreate, putting new voices and new sound effects and new music and everything in. So I know that film really, really well. But it's not as fresh, but okay. It's amazing.
Well, I love your explanation about why you maybe dozed off a little bit at the movie, your synaptic overload. That might explain something. My wife could never get through Nightmare Before Christmas without falling asleep. I'm not sure she ever saw it all the way to the end. And I was always wondering, why is this film having this effect on her? And this sounds like it might very well be the explanation. Sometimes there's just so much going on that you just, your brain says, I've got to shut down a little bit so I can process it.
It's a weird feeling. I remember watching those movies and not being bored in any way, shape, or form, but still, you know, I drop off. It's a weird thing. It happens really, really rarely, and usually happens with the same filmmakers over and over. So, you know, Terry Gilliam's one of them, and Chicken Run did that for me.
Well, I drop off during movies nowadays, but it has nothing to do with synaptic overload. it's just, you know, time of day sometimes.
Yes.
I like this movie fine. Like we've said a couple of times, this is solid. It's entertaining. There's nothing about it that I thought was particularly bad. There were some things about it that kind of threw me a little bit as I was watching it. I'm one of the fans of the original Chicken Run. I was on that show. I think everybody gave it 4.5 or 5 on the Lamb scores. So it wasn't anything that there was a problem with in regard to that, except by comparison purposes. And I had a couple of places where I'm making some comparisons and finding it to be a little bit problematic. I don't know. The new character of Molly is also a little bit maybe too cliche, trope, repeaty kind of stuff. You know, the teenager kind of thing seems to be overdone in a lot of these movies where we just have to have a rebellious character for the purpose of being...
conflict.
You know, yeah, we got to have some conflict. On the other hand, I did love the opening section where... even before she's out of the shell, she's a rebellious character. I appreciated that little bit of humor in the film, and I thought that there were a lot of places where they're doing those kinds of things. So it's positive comments from me for the most part, with a few reservations here and there. And, of course, by necessity, comparison is just one of those things that's going to pop into your head. If you are a fan of the first film, you're going to be looking at things in this film and saying, well, that's different, or that's not what I was looking for, or they did it better before, or there's something unsettling about what's happening here. And we're going to find out about some of those things. So let's move on to some other topics. By the way, I got the topic or the subtitle Dawn of the Nugget, and I went into two different directions with it. Of course, first we've got the food product that we're talking about, but we also have the story of Molly being, you know, the Ginger and Rocky's nugget, so to speak. And I thought that maybe was intentional, or maybe it's just my imposition of, you know, the way my brain is working here. But I like the idea that we're introducing something new to the storyline, that it's not just a continuation of the same characters, but we're going to add something to it that we didn't have before. And I think especially after 23 years, the idea that you're going to have a hatchling, a child as part of the follow-up story, that makes a lot of sense. Of course, 23 years in a chicken's life would probably be well past their sell-by date.
Yeah, the plot, it feels a little Route 1 in terms of, how do we make a sequel to Chicken Run? They all escape from Chicken Run. Well, these two get together, they have a kid, it's kidnapped, break in. So it just kind of feel like a quick afternoon.
This is always what was going the plot. To be.
Yeah, it didn't take any giant leaps. But then it's a sequel. It's very Toy Story 2. As well, the whole plot of like a character gets kidnapped or taken somewhere imprisoned, and the rest of the team like going up and go and rescue them, and occasionally hide in inanimate objects and walk along, and there's a bad guy dressed as a big chicken. There's a lot of Toy Story 2 parallels in the Nugget, I could see.
Well, if you're gonna take from a sequel, and maybe people may not agree with you, but if you're gonna take a sequel, taking from Toy Story 2 is a good way to start.
Yeah. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, I think they steal from a lot of other films. Obviously, the first film was The Great Escape, and this is just Mission Impossible.
There's some of the island in there. There's some Logan's Run.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so they're acknowledging that there are cultural touchstones that are going to be part of this series of films that, you know, we should just kind of expect. And I didn't see that as being too problematic, but it didn't seem as original as stealing the first time. How about we'll get to a little bit more of the story in a second. Somebody mentioned it earlier. It took you a little while to get used to the replacement of Mel Gibson, and Jay had to explain to somebody why Mel was not necessarily the actor that you wanted returning to this role.
The much less controversial choice of Zachary Levi.
Yes, well,
he is less controversial than Mel Gibson. I think that is fair. Controversy free.
But to me, it did more than just replace the voice character. It really felt a little bit like the character was a lot different from the first film. Now, I didn't watch the first film again in anticipation of this. I should have done that, or maybe it was a good thing that I didn't do that, because my memory of the Mel Gibson version of Rocky was that character seemed a lot more confident and capable and competent, and we seemed to be getting like the Dudley Do-Right version of Rocky here, you know, somebody who is thinks of themselves as being, you know, the Lone Ranger. You know, a lone free ranger character, but is really a doofus.
Relationships will do that to you, right?
Yeah, and he's had
becoming
a kid
now. Dad will do that to you.
Yeah. I was fine. I picked up on the same thing, Richard. But I think in the first film, a lot of that confidence is bravado, and when Rocky gets down to it, he's not actually that useful. He's not that good at things.
It's the whole thing of where, like, when they break into the pie machine and Rocky falls into every single pie in there.
Exactly.
Before Ginger drags him out.
It's a lot of false confidence. And I think Zachary Levi, he's good at playing kids who are grown up. He's, you know, he's Shazam. So he brings a lot of that same Shazam energy of, like, you know, he's along for the ride. He's gonna do his best. He's really confident gonna do it, but he's gonna ultimately get taken out by some robot moles and ducks and a big vacuum. Like, and that felt fine to me. That felt the same as Rocky. And I think he sounds enough like the original Rocky as well. I think that all worked. Seems to be a good choice.
And I think for me, if there's any character that felt a bit more exaggerated in this one, it was Fowler. They definitely play up the, like, they make him more like Grandpa Simpson here than, like, the more fussy RAF veteran that we get in the first one.
Which, again, he's older. There's been a bit of a sharp decline. But I feel like that makes sense, maybe. as discussed, lifespan of a chicken. Not long. But then I don't think it's been a real life 23-year gap in story wise between the two.
No, I don't think it's supposed to be. But it has been long enough for them to have a child who basically reaches, you know, what the equivalent would be in teen years. I could tell you if it was dog years, you know, what the measure would be, but I haven't really done a chicken comparison.
So chickens reach puberty between 16 and 24 weeks of age. I've just Googled it.
Okay.
really? So that's not in my Google history. Great.
I'm going to be worried about what your Google recommends you now.
Yeah, what you're going to be
seeing. Mama Tweety got to work
weeks.
Fast.
Yeah, sure. We don't know how far along Fry was with his machine, I guess.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the story points. You know, these films are made for a family audience, you know, and whenever you get the phrase family audience, that sounds like it's, you know, here's something for kids to babysit them, as opposed to here's something that everybody can enjoy together. A lot of good films. Obviously, we've mentioned some of the Pixar films have a great deal of appeal to adults as well as to kids. And I think the original Chicken Run did that as well. Does anybody feel like this was a step down that was more kid-oriented, or did you think it did a pretty good job at sticking with something that's available to everybody in the family?
Yeah, I think it's fine for the whole family. I don't think this is too, like, much for kids. I think anybody, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some sort of, like, Ginger's PTSD over, you know, everything that happened at Tweety's farm and that kind of backgrounds from there. Those are kind of, like, elements that the kid, like, feel a bit more mature and feel like a bit more, like, fairly natural evolution for the character of Ginger as compared to in the first one. And, yeah, it does feel like it's keeping that bit. There are some jokes that feel a bit more kid-friendly, like, and you definitely see, like, you know, the snail we see. It feels like another British image of, like, the slugs from Flushed Away in Irons, trying to get, you know, something a bit more, you know, obviously kid-friendly. But, yeah, I feel like a lot of it does have that more family-friendly vibe to it, for the most part.
James, you sounded like sections. You were amused by the PTSD reference.
Yeah, very much so. And that's something that would go right over a kid's head. You know, but it's not something that is going to be upsetting. But I think adults would certainly understand what that was. You know, the best films are the ones, the best animated films are the one, family films are the ones that the parents can enjoy as much as the kids, and kind of look at each other and go, okay, we may have a talk later. But, you know, I like that. It's better than, you know, doing your basic troll movie pablum.
I would say the original, though, has quite a few jokes that the kids aren't going to get, as far as, you know, all the homages to things like The Great Escape and, you know, stuff like that, and you know, stuff with, like, the RAF days and things like that. I would say that, but it's fine because they're engaged in the overall plot and the characters, and there's just something for everybody in both films, I'd say.
I always wonder if a kid, what, you know, who grew up on Chicken Run, then later in life as a teen sees The Great Escape and goes, wait a minute, they ripped off.
Exactly, yeah. What happened to me. Exactly what happened to me.
Yeah. For sure.
Okay, yeah. Jay, which do you prefer?
The Great Escape.
Of course.
The Great Escape is in my top 4 on S-Books. Like, Chicken Run would be in my top 30, 50, I don't know. No, right.
You just up. Like escape movies, is what you're saying.
I do really like prison escape films. I really do. Deep Blue Sea is a prison escape film. That's why I do a podcast all about it. The sharks are the prisoners.
I guess if I was a little surprised that the movie wasn't stronger, it's because I thought that both of the Shaun the Sheep movies were on the same level, were both really strong. There's nothing wrong with it. It's fine. But I guess I was just expecting it to be stronger because it's Aardman, and because in the sequel that they'd done for Shaun the Sheep, it was as good, if not maybe even better than the first Shaun the Sheep. I mean, it was on the same level, in my opinion, at least. And so, you know, expectations just factor so much into things that, you know, you try as a critic not to have that be the case, but it's sometimes it's hard.
Yeah, I had low expectations for Farmageddon, and I loved it.
It's so good.
That's the alternate for me.
Yeah, Farmageddon is it was really good.
Yeah. Better than this. And this is still a fine film. I feel like I'm coming off more negative than I want to.
Me too. But
James has already cast us aside for coming off more negative than we intend, but that's all right. We'll make it through the show.
Yeah, there were some, like, more, not adult, but, like, more grown-up jokes that didn't really pay off that much. Like, one of the chickens who gets selected is chicken number 314. I was like, oh, it's going to be chicken pie. Not turned into a pie. It's turned into something else, not a pie. Is that intentional? I feel cheated.
Yeah.
Do you suppose there was a sequence that they didn't cut? Do you think there's a payoff on that joke that they had to take out because it was going to be too time consuming to do the animation?
Well, I mean, maybe. it's the whole point is it gets turned into nuggets, and it would be odd because it's a nugget machine, but that we've ventured far into spoilers at this point.
Yeah, I think. Well, let's face it. If the title of the film gives away a big chunk of what we're about to talk about, so anybody listening, there aren't a lot of spoilers in this film. You know, it's just it goes where you expect it to go. So
like the big spoiler is the one they gave away in the trailers was the return of Mrs. Tweedy.
Yes,
she'll have her revenge. Yes, which is good. I don't know how she survived
that fall.
Yeah.
And being crushed by a door.
Well, she apparently landed on Mr. Tweedy.
In this film, she survives being deep fried. So let's not even.
Yeah. That was, by the way, one of the elements of the film that I thought I didn't need. That it was, to me, a little bit. I get, you know, people who are critics of. Return of the Jedi because we're back to a Death Star. Guess what? We've got the same kind of villain plot point that we had in the first film coming back on this, and that seems like it was not necessary. We had Dr. Fry. Why do we need to have Mrs. Tweedy return in this process? It was not. It just seemed like it was a crutch there to connect it to the earlier film, as opposed to something that was interesting and worthwhile. But you know. Maybe you disagree. Rachel agrees with me.
Well, yeah, I mean, because if you think about, again, Farmageddon, like, was really quite different than the first Shaun the Sheep, which the first Shaun the Sheep is kind of an homage to silent movies, and it's almost Chaplin-esque, in my opinion, at least. And then to follow it up with this sci-fi alien story is quite different. And I wish they had been a little more creative in that way.
Well, it is helpful that Mrs. Tweedy now has a second husband who is apparently independently wealthy and can afford to have the technology that they couldn't have on the other farm.
I don't know how nobody ever came out with the Chicken Run Mrs. Tweedy thighs. In all these years. I think like that would be a gold mine.
Well, you would think. I was wondering why. Traumatic. Do you think McDonald's should be doing McNuggets that are tied into Chicken Run here? Yeah. Dawn of the McNugget.
Oh, that would be great. Happy Meal toy. Oh, they should have been doing that.
Well,
the one great thing about Mrs. Tweedy being back is she has, in my opinion, one of the best jokes in the film. Just her walking down that staircase for so long. given that, as James has said, it's all done so painstakingly. It takes them ages to do a single frame, and they spend like 25 seconds just watching her walk down the stairs step by step.
One step at a time, yes.
One step at a time.
Bum, bum, bum. Well, let's see. I mentioned Dr. Fry as a character, and we have this factory that they are breaking into, this, what is it, they call it, Funland Farms?
Yes.
And the whole idea is that if the chickens are happy when they go to their final resting place as a nugget, they're going to taste so much better.
It's so chilling.
it's a little weird. It's a little weird. Well, you know, years ago on a radio station in Southern California, the morning team had a routine where they talked about how the food was so much better, the meats were so much better if you were cruel to the meats, you know. And they did this routine where, you know, you teased and insulted the animals before you killed them, and you know did all these horrible things, and it was gruesomely amusing. And this is going the opposite direction. We're going to, you know, basically hypnotize them and make them live in the Truman Show world, where they everything is perfect, it's just a facade, but it'll look really nice, and they'll be happy to be there, except it doesn't matter that they have all of that facade because they're all hypnotized.
Why is it what is it for? Why aren't they just in case?
It's like you say, it's been just to make, you know, keep them active. Active before they mulch them up. Well, yeah, I feel like when you get the hypnotizing, the really getting some pretty creaky territory there with the blank eyes, the monotone voice, and most terrifyingly of all, being willing to sing Cliff Richard songs. That's how you know things are wrong with him.
I did enjoy when they tried to do the same thing to Ginger. He has like a little nod to Barbarella of overpowering the machine, but it still works in the end. So not quite, and in a different method.
Yeah, it's basically turning every chicken into Babs.
Sure. Who knits a bicycle? We can't forget she knits a bicycle in this. Yeah, it doesn't work, good. But she still knits a bicycle.
That was a good visual joke. I like that quite a bit, by the way. So, what other kinds of visual elements, jokes, clever bits did you appreciate, or were there any that you thought kind of fell flat? For me, the laser robots and the armed ducks felt a little eh. You know, I know it. Yeah, like they've got the tech going and they're going to put it into the film, and it's look, they made these jokes in Austin Powers 20 years ago and we're getting the same things back. You know, why can't I get a freaking laser beam on my shark?
Yeah, and okay, so they're guarding the place. When all the chickens break in, they all dive underwater and get past them and everything. And then Nick and Fetcher just drop out of the cloud thing they have. Why couldn't they all just drop out of the cloud thing?
And why wouldn't they want the chickens breaking in? All they have to do is let the chickens break in and then they collar them.
More chickens!
Yeah. Well, it feels like more less to keep the chicken, to stop chickens getting in, more to Mrs. Tweedy learning her lesson from the last one and stopping chickens getting out.
Yeah, guys, we have a villain who's improved, so that's good.
Guys, these chickens talk.
The humans can't understand them. That's a good rule. I like that.
I'm still creeped out by the fact that the chickens have teeth.
Yes, hen's teeth. Yeah,
hen's teeth.
And they wear little hats and knit,
which is rare.
Well, that didn't bother me, but the little hats were kind of cute. But the teeth.
Abomination.
Well, it's an Aardman film. Of course they're going to have teeth.
I know.
I mean, the cars in their gas commercials had teeth. Grills.
The cars in cars have teeth.
Yeah.
They shouldn't. That's a whole different nightmare.
Which one is going to keep you up? Yes. Which one's going to keep you up at night? The cars having teeth or the chickens having teeth? Right now, it's the chickens for me, but I know it's different.
What keeps me up at night about the cars franchise is in the third one, when one of them talks about their grandfather talking to them. So somehow these cars have a lineage. And that's what I can't get past.
cars is the logical endpoint of Titan.
Unless you're an Edsel, then you have no lineage. Okay, we're getting far afield from Chicken Run here. Sorry.
Well, I mentioned that I hadn't watched the original before watching this. Did anybody take the time to watch the original and kind of do this immediate sort of comparison?
I didn't, but I feel like I didn't need to. It's in my head. It's ingrained.
I've watched it so many.
Everybody else was good to go on it. They knew it so well that they didn't need to have those references. That's fine. I was just wondering if it suffered a little bit more by comparison.
125 Christmas movies aren't watching themselves.
Yeah, you got other things to take care of. And once again, a reason why I appreciate you being with us this week, because I know that you've got other things that you have to take care of. Does anybody know why this is not getting a theatrical release, other than the fact that Netflix probably paid for part of it?
Yeah, just Netflix.
It's getting a limited release. I mean, well, for me, this, like I said, I'm sorry, The Washhead in Bristol, and that's been showing it fairly regularly over the past 2 weeks. It's, I think it's doing the same thing Netflix always does, and fairly limited releases more to get an Oscar-qualifying run. And I mean, the only time I know that they've done a proper wide release was with Glass Onion last year.
Yeah. So, but it, on IMDb, it is saying that it's had a limited cinema release in the States a week ago. Yeah, but probably only in like New York and LA.
Sometimes those come to Salt Lake, but not this one.
Yeah, I didn't see it any place in my area, you know. But no. I live a different place now, so maybe it was all over the place in Southern California.
It looks like it just had a cinema release in America, in the UK, and in Spain, and nowhere else.
But this is one case. I mean, it's a shame that Netflix does that, but it is a case where I am kind of grateful for Netflix, because, I mean, it was just not, Aardman was not succeeding with the release strategy. Even when they were with DreamWorks, it was, Chicken Run was obviously successful, but I don't know, people, it just seems like it's really hard to get people to go see stop motion animated films. I don't know why. Because the Leica movies struggle too. Despite being quality for the most part, I think people are just accustomed to computer CGI, you know, animation, and the Wes Anderson movies didn't do it. I mean, I just can't think of a stop motion animated film that has done well in a long, long time since Coraline. I mean, it's been a long time, and so I'm kind of grateful that Netflix is keeping Aardman alive, because I love, you know, them as a studio.
I know that
Netflix are doing more stuff with Aardman as well in the future. Like, they've been doing some Shaun the Sheep stuff very recently. And if I'm remembering it right, Nick Park's doing a new Wallace and Gromit short with Netflix, which is going to be Netflix release in the US, BBC in the UK.
Is that a short or a feature?
I think it's a short.
Yeah, I actually got to interview Nick Park years and years ago before Early Man came out, which is another film didn't do well. It's amazing the creativity and ingenuity that they have there at Aardman. So I'm glad somebody's investing in them and keeping them alive.
Do you think maybe modern audiences are sort of reacting the way they might to a black and white film or a silent film? They've just gotten conditioned to seeing, you know, an animated film needs to look like a Pixar film or a Disney film, or else it's just old-fashioned and not something that I'm interested in.
I think so. I really do. I don't know. I think they're just used to the CGI and
not willing to venture out the comfort zone.
Yeah, I think that I like that phrase. You know, not willing to get out of the comfort zone.
I am glad to see that more ambitious CGI is getting embraced by audiences. So that's kind of a step in the right direction, as far as, you know, Spider-Verse and, you know, the new Ninja Turtles movie and Puss in Boots and things like that, that are trying to mix different styles of animation and be a little bit more ambitious in the medium. I don't know. Stop motion just doesn't seem popular here in the United States.
Where's our Lego Batman 2? Damn it.
Right. I am here. I am waiting. It has been.
Yeah, another thing, things like the Lego movies, it's those ones that were all CG designed to look like stop motion, but you can still tell that it was CG.
And they didn't do that good. I mean,
And they're the best films ever made, so I don't understand.
They were successes, but not like huge successes. Well, except for Ninjago, that was a lot.
Yes, certainly so. Yeah. Lego Batman movie, I stand by being one of the greatest films in all of history.
That's fun. Have you checked out Merry Little Batman?
No, I have not. I don't know what to say.
If you love Lego Batman, then you probably like Merry Little Batman.
That's on the Amazon, isn't it?
Yeah, it shouldn't have been an hour and a half. It was too long, but it still was. It's a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
I have to go.
It's Dick Wilson that's playing Batman in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've heard that's the problem with it as well. Is the only thing I've heard about it is he's not good.
Oh well, he was fine.
Judge for myself.
Okay, we're quiet. But I just thought it was the jokes made me laugh, and the animation is pretty inventive. But yeah, I mean it. Yeah, that's a whole nother topic. But I know I just I'm grateful to Netflix for. I mean, not only are they investing in Aardman, but you know they did obviously with Pinocchio last year, so with Guillermo del Toro, and so investing in stop motion there is, you know, was really exciting. Plus they had, you know, they've done traditional animation and Claws and
reviving like other animated projects that other studios and kind of like getting the Mona release.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh yeah, yeah, that's true too. Yeah.
Well, yeah. We seem to have gone far afield from Dawn of the Nugget, but we are still in the general vicinity of animated claymation stop motion films.
Well, I think we have to talk about the voice casting. That seems like the most controversial aspect of this movie, as far as especially with Thandi Newton getting cast instead of the original voice actress.
Julia Sawala.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, she sounds too old these days, apparently.
Well, and she did a whole video showing that she doesn't sound too old. And it's so weird because it's not like Thandi Newton is like some big name. Like, it's not like Julia Roberts is doing it. You know what I mean? Like, is she really so much of a draw? Like, I mean, she's fine. Like, she does a fine job, but like, I don't know. It just seems like a confusing.
Yeah, so I think of it's not being really consistent about, was they brought back like Imelda Staunton, Jane Horrocks, Lynn Ferguson, Miranda Richardson, then replaced like Julia Sawala, Timothy Spall, Phil Daniels, and Mel Gibson. I mean, the whole thing, it feels like they did the recasting because they wanted more and just an excuse to not bring back Mel Gibson,
which is fair. But then why the replacing of Timothy Spall and Daniel Mays that I find, like, why did you, sorry, and Phil Daniels, like, why? There's like, who's going to see a film because Daniel Mays is voicing Fetcher? I like Daniel Mays. I love Ramesh Ranganathan. I like him both.
I like Daniel Mays, actually,
the second time Ranganathan's playing a voicing a rodent in a film. That's nice.
Those two, like, I actually got used to Ramesh Ranganathan fairly quickly, Nick? Yeah. But actually, the person who taught me the longest to get used to was Daniel Mays, and I really like Daniel Mays's work, it just didn't sound quite right to me for the longest while.
To quote my wife, they're trying to trick me, and I don't appreciate it. I stand by that, but I think there's few roles that you can say Timothy Spall, Ramesh Ranganathan, you're playing the same character, so I like it from that perspective. But it just feels odd, like this Timothy Spall and Daniels still both working, both recognizable names, would probably cost about the same, maybe less, than Ramesh and Daniel Mays. I think Thandi Newton did a good job, but I couldn't get past it. Why not just bring Julia Sawala back? I did an unintentional double bill of Thandi Newton films with Mission Impossible 2 immediately before Dawn of the Nugget. It was just on TV. That was fun. she's not a massive draw. I like her. I like Julia Sawala. What? I don't know.
The only other actor I feel like it was like obvious that they need to get a new actor in was with Fowler, because Benjamin Whitrow was passed away a while ago, and when writing that character, it just kind of manifests David Bradley. I think before you finish writing the script, David Bradley's just there to record the voice.
Like, his picture on Wikipedia looks like Fowler. Like he, it just he's perfect.
My guess is that very few people choose to see an animated film primarily because of the voice actors that have been cast. That might have an influence on a film like the Toy Story movies, but outside of something like that, I don't think people worry too much about it, except for the comparison that's being made. And like I said, for me, the only voice that was noticeably different that bothered me was Zachary Levi, and I got used to it within a few minutes, but the character seemed different as a consequence. But everybody else, you know, they're playing by type, and everybody sounded like the types that they are playing, so I didn't really notice those sorts of things. I don't know what the internal machinations are for those sorts of things. Somebody, maybe it's a money issue, maybe it's a timing issue, maybe the director has worked with somebody else before. There's always some reason that somebody did it, and then there's some justification that has to be presented in case if it turns into a controversy.
But I love Peter Serafinich's voice. I'm always happy when he just crops up in something as the.
Although when I was watching the cinema, for the longest time, I thought until the credits, I thought it was Simon Pegg.
Sure.
It does sound quite a lot like Simon Pegg.
I feel like they probably do impressions of each other. So
yeah.
I feel like
that's... And that's the other thing. You could just get impressionists to do somebody, but maybe you'd get sued for that.
We're just going to like John Coleshaw to do all the voices.
I don't know who John Coleshaw is.
No.
No.
Well, go listen to some Dead Ringers.
I got you.
Google Dead Ringers and
I kind of inferred what was being said and understood the concept, even though I don't know the particular person. You know, it's like Rich Little. Oh, we'll just cast Rich Little for all the characters in the movie. Same sort of thing. I just assumed it was somebody who is good at mimicking other people's voices.
I'm nodding as if I know who Rich Little is. So, there with you, Rich.
Exactly. All right. All right. Well, do you guys have, you know, as we finish this off, do you have any final comments that you wanted to make about the film that we haven't had a chance to talk about? Rachel, is there something else that you wanted to get in? I know you said you didn't really think of a bunch of things that you wanted to talk about. Is there anything that popped in to your head while we were talking?
I'll just say it's okay for movies to just be fine. I get, you know, to just be, it's okay. It's a decent movie. It's, yeah, there you go. Not everything has to be a masterpiece.
As so many movies prove.
Yes.
Tony, do you have any final thoughts on Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget?
I mean, I think it's all I want to say. Well, I think the only thing that's interesting is with these two, you know, between Chicken Run and Wonka with the boats for which would have been covered. No matter what, it would have been either film would have been another entry in the Taskmaster cinematic universe.
So just for me, not for no one else. So I approve.
Yeah.
James, how about you? Something to finish off with?
Nothing that I haven't said before. You know, I'll go see the next Aardman film, even if it's a remake.
That's fine. Well, look, I've got a question that everybody can answer, and maybe we can make that our final exit question on this film. What's your favorite fast food chicken?
Oh, goodness.
I mean, the one I was talking about earlier, it's a British chain, Seven Bone. Seven Bone is a really good chicken sandwich, but they do a side that's called Fish Caramel Chicken Wings. That's maybe the best thing I've ever had. It's chicken wings in a fish caramel sauce. Tony, if I was going on the Off Menu podcast, this would be my starter. Maybe my side. I don't know.
Popeyes.
Popeyes? Oh, man. Popeyes is okay. I'm afraid Chick-fil-A, they put crack or something in there. It's one of those things that I eat and I go, why is this so good and why am I eating it again? This is not really what I should be doing.
Where are my teeth?
Yes.
I got to go with old school KFC, extra crispy.
Like the extra crispy.
I mean, I don't know if you'd count it as like fast food, but I'm a Nando's person.
Absolutely, that's fast food.
All right. Well, if any of our chickens end up in any of these fast food chains, we'll let you know, and we'll recommend whether you should get extra crispy or original. We're going to take a very quick break here to hear from.
Hang on. I didn't get to my final thoughts.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jay.
I have final thoughts.
You do have final thoughts, really?
Yes, I have three.
Well, give us your three final thoughts.
Early on in the film, there's a chat between Ginger, Rocky, and Molly, where they're talking about the things that can't be taken away from her. And Molly's response is, "Our freedom." And I feel like if Mel Gibson was voicing Rocky, that would have had a better. but there we go. One of my favorite jokes in the film is the retinal scan that turns out is just somebody leafing through pictures of zoomed in eyeballs. And this is the second film covered on the Lambcast this year that ends with a building being filled with popcorn. Done. Move on. Real genius.
Real genius, I was just going to say. You know, I saw that popcorn thing coming because I said there's a reason that we're having this at the beginning of the movie. You know, popcorn is going to make a return appearance here.
This kind of film getting the fairly prominent release, be able to have any character with a proper thick Scouse accent.
Oh, hell yeah. But the popcorn thing, I feel like there should have been, for those people seeing it in cinema, there should have been a warning 10 minutes before the film starts. Like, you will want popcorn during this film. Go and get it now.
Get it before because the movie starts.
Exactly. So we had to pause and go and get some. So thank God we weren't seeing it in the cinema.
Well, I was just going to say, nobody really had to worry about that except in very few places because it wasn't in cinemas. It was in most people's homes where they could get the popcorn as soon as that scene came on. All right. Well, we've popped our corn. We got Jay's final three thoughts in. We're going to take a quick break here to hear from a fellow Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we're going to come back for our quick exit question of the week.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm John.
And we are the hosts of the Popcorn Auteur, a movies podcast where each episode we immerse ourselves in and critique the works of a famous filmmaker.
The concept is pretty straightforward. Chris and I pick a famous filmmaker, watch their films over a short time frame, then we talk about the films, mispronounce French words, and answer definitively, is this filmmaker an auteur, and do we like them?
Subscribe and download episodes on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play.
We've returned here, and it's now time to get off of our show for the week by talking about our exit question. The exit question, by the way, has been working pretty well this year. I moved away from doing some of the things that we'd done in the past, rants, raves, and reviews, and we've gone with the exit question. And normally I would have given people a week's notice about the exit question, think about it. But this week I screwed up, and they only got the exit question right before the show started. So the quality of their answer is largely a result of my short-sightedness as opposed to people's deep thoughts. The exit question this week is, what's your favorite stop-motion or claymation-style animated film? James, let's start with you.
Not too far afield. The Wrong Trousers.
Yeah.
Wallace and Gromit.
Yeah.
There was just something about that movie that enchanted me all the way through. And just something about one of the great things about Aardman is how they can achieve something. I always remember the penguin and how evil it was merely by their animation of it. That still haunts my dreams.
That has one of the best like action set pieces thing I've seen in the film with the train chase in the end.
Yes. Must have taken forever to do that. I saw a documentary a long time ago where they were talking about doing that scene, and it just seemed like these people are insane. But they obviously love what they do.
Tony, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, my actual favorite stop motion film is the original Chicken Run. But since I feel like I've talked quite a lot about Chicken Run, I'm going to go with my second favorite one, which is Adam Elliott's Mary and Max. Which, you know, it's actually it's a you know, it's like we've been talking about a lot of the family friendly kind of stuff we've been getting with Aardman. Mary Max is not that kind of film. It's a pretty, you know, dark, depressed, sad, bittersweet film. Which, if people who aren't familiar with it, it's about a young girl living in Australia who ends up becoming pen pals with a, like, somewhat with a man in living in New York with Asperger's. And it ends up being, like, just really touching, sorry about the friendship, the actual stop-motion animation. I don't know quite how to describe it, but charmingly ugly is probably the best way to describe it. Like, a lot of the characters, there's, like, little... There's things about the character designs that don't quite feel natural, but it works for the style that Adam Elliott's going for. Like, really great performances from all the cast, mainly from Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's brilliant in it. And yeah, I mean, it's one where, yeah, you know, it's a really, you know, dark film, but in all places, like, talk about mental health issues, suicide, depression, all that fun stuff.
All that stuff you want at the kids' matinee.
Yeah, everything a child needs to see. Yeah, I just find it really, like, great, touching film. And also, as a side for that, also highly recommend his Adam Elliott's previous short film, Harvey Crumpet, as well as a good little addition to watch alongside Mary Max.
Harvey Crumpet, huh? Okay.
Yeah, that's definitely underappreciated, that movie. It's really good. Mary and Max.
Yeah.
Rachel, what's your favorite?
I have a lot that I love, but I think my favorite, I have to give it to Coraline. Not only is it visually so inventive and a great way to introduce kids to the tropes of horror, and it's legitimately terrifying. The button eyes will stay with you. Just visually, it's just outstanding. But I really love Coraline as a character. I think that she has to decide to fight for her parents, even though they are legitimately terrible people and have treated her terrible. And that's hard. You know, it's easy to love people that love you. It's harder to love people that don't deserve it, really. And here she's presented with this idyllic version of what she, you know, wants, but she recognizes it so quickly that it's a lie. I think that she's just such a wonderful character, a great protagonist, and like I said, it just is such a visually stunning, creative, inventive movie with great heart, I think.
And also great about Coraline as well is, like, I've read the Neil Gaiman book that it starts it from, mm-hmm. and it's actually really loyal adaptation, and even, like, some of the things which, you know, they've made changes to are ones that work better for the film, actually work better for the story. Like,
yeah,
in the book, the other mother has the more, like, unnatural, monstrous, like, overly tall appearance when right from the start, rather than you see the film of it going, like, starting as mm-hmm. looking exactly the same, then getting that more monstrous appearance as the film goes on. I think mm-hmm. that actually works better for the horror.
Yeah, it draws you in.
Jay, it's your turn.
Hello. Yes, I also have a lot that I really like. Picked quite serious ones. So if I would have to pick a serious one, I would say from earlier this year, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On.
But
that's not my favorite. My favorite is The Pirates and Eventual Scientists, which is a very silly film. It's another Arden film. It's Pirates Band of Misfits in America, isn't it?
Yes.
Which, you know, there should be a whole series of these at this point. There's just one I don't understand.
Well, I think the second one in the book series was The Pirates and the Adventure of Communists, so...
Sure. Okay. I haven't read any of the books, but maybe they could skip that one or rename it The Pirates versus the Bolsheviks. I don't know. But I think this film was incredibly fun. Well, a wonderful cast. Like, one of Hugh Grant's best roles, maybe his best role. I mean, after Phoenix Buchanan, I haven't seen Wonka yet.
I feel like the more changing Hugh Grant scene, the more hammy, if that's the right word, roles nice. Again from Hugh Grant. Nice. It kind of started with this one.
I think so, yes. Because there's so much comedy in this one. This is why I have high hopes for any Aardman film, just because there's so much in this film. Every moment has lots of background gags and so much going on, which was maybe missing from Dawn of the Nugget in some bits. But I have watched this film 100 times, and I love it every time. And yet we still haven't covered it on Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, yet, despite being entirely aquatic. It's on the list. We'll get it. So we haven't given Finding Nemo, which I've seen 1,000 times. We'll do it one day. There's sharks in it. We have to. But yeah, I love The Pirates and Adventure with Scientists. It's so much fun. And I'll watch it. I watched it earlier this year. I'll watch it again tomorrow. I don't know. It's never a bad time to watch.
Okay, well, that's...
Richard, what's yours?
Oh, mine's easy. Mine was my favorite film of 2018. It's Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs, you know, which I just adore. And I think is... it's got the same meticulous kind of craftsmanship that you see in the Aardman films, but with the Wes Anderson sensibility, and it's about dogs, and I'm just a sucker for dog stories because I'm a sucker for dogs. I just, that's what pulls me in on this particular one. And I love a lot of movies that have stop motion in them. I could sit down and watch a Ray Harryhausen film anytime, some of which are not very good, but they have great things in them because they've got that going on. The first movie that I remember as a kid adoring and loving is King Kong, and there's that movement in there that is like, oh my gosh, look at this. And I know it's it seems like it's antiquated technology that I'm more entranced by that than the things that we can do now with the CGI, because I know that somebody worked hard to make this work in the circumstances they were operating in, and I just think it looks great. I'm all down with that. So the stop motion animation, the claymation, I'm happy to see these kinds of films. We've got a whole list of things that people have suggested here that I've not seen that I'm looking forward to catching up with, and I appreciate that. That's kind of where I'm going to finish off. So does anybody have any final thoughts and things? Let's go around and see what people have to talk about that they want to share, plug. I know that Jay is still under the sea someplace talking about sharks or pirates or something on Deep Blue Sea, the podcast. What have you got for us this week, Jay?
Well, darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me. We've just covered the original Little Mermaid, and the remake from 2023 is coming very soon. You can find those on Deep Blue Sea, the podcast. I've also been celebrating Happy Harlan Days with a couple of Rennie Harlan films, The Legend of Hercules, and our final festive Rennie Harlan film, Bodies at Rest, which, no, you haven't heard of it, don't worry.
Okay.
It's from his Chinese period, where he was in China for a while. Bodies at Rest, actually a really good film. It's like Die Hard in a morgue. it's available on Daily Motion. Nowhere else. So I recommend people watch it. That was fun. I was also a guest on Howard's podcast, Pop Art. I mean, I'm his regular Christmas guest. To talk about... he picked the popular film this time. He picked Windchill, and I picked the art film of Dead End. I had heard of neither of these films prior to watching them for this podcast episode. So take what you will as to which one's popular, which one's art. But I had a fun time talking about these two films, about people traveling for Christmas and things going awry on the way. And I was also a guest on Todd's podcast, The Forgotten Filmcast, to talk about Hello Down There, an underwater film about a bunch of people who chest out a newfangled techno underwater house. And get attacked by sharks. So we released it on Forgotten Films and also TBC the podcast. It's a crossover. So find it at either of those places.
Oh, I like that crossover. That's good.
It meant less editing.
Yes. I only have to do it once. There you are.
Yeah, it's great.
Rachel, I know that you are in the middle of the season and you have 125 of these movies. Which ones do you want us to tune to?
Yeah, it's been an interesting season as far as the holiday movies. We've been covering it, my podcast, Hallmarkies Podcast. There's been some standouts, favorite one called Rescuing Christmas that I highly recommend with Rachel Lee Cook that was very funny. And so check that one out. Very inventive as well. But we cover them all over at Hallmarkies Podcast. And so, yeah, and I cover animation, Rachel's Reviews. I have a monthly Disney series I do with my friend, also Obscure Animation. We've had episodes on – we had an episode on Mary and Max and for that one. So if you love animation, check that out.
Rachel, did you watch Round and Round with Mick Michaelis?
I sure did. Absolutely.
Any good? I'm a fan of hers, but it's not out over here yet. So
yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I think that would be like a good gateway to Hallmark movies or Christmas. I mean, it's a Hanukkah movie, but there's a lot of pop culture references, and it's pretty edgy in the world of Hallmark, at least. and it's genuinely very, very funny. It's a time warp, a time loop story. So yeah, that one's one of the better ones.
A time loop story entitled Round and Round. Imagine that.
Round and Round.
Tony, you got something you want us to turn our eyes and ears toward?
Yeah, so if we all the episodes of my podcast doing a run through of the original 1973 version of The Wicker Man now being released. I'm very thankful for Jay to being the guest on the first episode of it.
Then, my customary role on these kinds of things. Just guess. Love it.
Over on my site, you can find all the reviews of films I saw at this year's London Film Festival. Also, recently done a review of Wonka. And you know, just as a fun little thing, when went to the BBC podcast and Rennie Harlin stuff, one of the best cinema experiences I had this year, which was going to the Forbidden Worlds Film Festival in Bristol. And one of the things they did there was a showing of Cliffhanger on an IMAX screen with an introduction from Rennie Harlin. And they had introductions for other people for some of the other films. Like, they did a showing of King Kong with an introduction from Peter Jackson. But then with Rennie Harlin, and the first of the introductions is like 2 or 3 minutes. Rennie Harlin's introduction was a full 15 minutes. And it's great hearing everyone in the audience slowly realize that Rennie Harlin was not stopping with his introduction.
He will never stop. You cannot shut that man up. It's great.
Sounds like fun to me. That's the way it's supposed to work. Let him go on. That's why you're having the guest.
But he does great film commentaries, and he is so honest in all of them about everything that went wrong. They're great. He loves talking about his films.
Well, James, I know that you never promote your site the way I think you should be promoting it. You got to have something that you want us to see.
No. you know, I don't want to make promises that it takes me 7 months to
fulfill.
We will have a post on the 25 films selected for the U.S. National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. Interesting group of films this year. They seem to have less of a political slant than they have in previous iterations, and there is one on the list that just looking at I kind of fell in love with because I'd never heard of it before, and it is so strange and so weird. It's called Queen of Diamonds, and it's almost done without dialogue. It's mostly just a day in the life of living in Las Vegas as a dealer.
And they always have like random home movies, like it's really,
I love those.
I
can't remember who. Every year they'll have like this year it was home movies of a family from the Philippines.
Yeah.
And
well, they do. They always do.
And which is great because, you know, part of the thing is just to look at things from a historical perspective. And these are people who, you know, they were taking home movies, but they were also preserving some sort of history that has completely gone away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at the list of all the films that are on, and it goes, I've just explored it. It goes from Decline of the Western Civilization to The Deer Hunter. Yeah. I feel like there's something missing between those two. It should be, something deep, something blue. I can't. It's just something should be included on this list. Where is Deep Blue Sea? I'm fine with Home Alone being on there. Great. Where is Deep Blue Sea?
Oh, I see. I think it's because Deep Blue Sea isn't old enough to be on the list. What are you talking about?
They did 12 Years a Slave this year.
Yes. Well. Okay. But
you tell me that's better than Deep Blue Sea.
We got to remember the registry is not a ranking of quality. It's, you know, there's not much chance that Deep Blue Sea is going to disappear from the consciousness of the film community, given the attention of the podcast that you have given to it.
Never thought I'd be asked.
12 Years a Slave versus Deep Blue Sea.
And Deep Blue Sea.
A film we will never cover on the show.
Because why? Why?
It's not water adjacent.
Because it's been done so exquisitely well in other portions.
All right. Well, on my podcast, this is it. You know, we're talking about these kinds of things. If you have not signed up, if you are not a subscriber to the YouTube channel for the Lambcast, you're missing out. I'm having way too much fun putting these videos together, and I'm learning how to do things that I didn't think I should know how to do, and I'm beginning to suspect you're going to get me in trouble at some point with the copyright laws around the world. But I'll wait for them to come after me before I worry about that too much. On my site,
I think you're fine if you don't do music. Music is the thing that takes them off.
Yeah, it takes them off.
Talk to DJ about that. He has to take some stuff down because of music.
Well, we have. We are not available in Russia because of the cake song at the end of the show.
Oh, okay. Really?
Yeah. You know, so
that's free. It's on.
That's the
something.
Only. That's the only one that we get kicked out of. So, you know, all of my former Soviet comrades are not able to tune in to the YouTube channel for the Lambcast because we're blocked there. But everywhere else, we're in good shape, at least for the moment.
Just another reason to kick Putin out.
Yes, there you are. And on my regular site, Kirkham A Movie A Day, I continue to update on all of the films that I've seen in theaters, and I'm just catching up with a ton of Christmas movies that have been playing in theaters. This week I saw, Die Hard again, and last week it was Arthur Christmas, and we had Muppet Christmas Carol was on Tuesday, and I had a fabulous experience with the Austin Symphony on Thursday night. They did the accompaniment to Home Alone. So all of your favorite Christmas films eventually are going to be getting some kind of notice on Kirkham A Movie A Day. So come by, say hi, see what my thoughts were. Sometimes I repeat myself. Imagine that. I've seen Die Hard 972 times, and I'm trying to write something different about it. No, that's not going to work. Sometimes it's just, hey, see this previous post. So that's the way it goes here. Well, I tell you what, we've had all the exciting stuff here. We don't have any laser-guided exploding ducks to finish off the show with, but I want to thank all of the guests who came on to talk about this. I'm glad that we found some things to talk about, despite the fact that everybody was, I won't say not enthusiastic, but they weren't overwhelmed by our selection this week. Glad to have talked about it, but not necessarily something that we're going to remember.
It's sort of like U.S. elections. We vote for it, but aren't enthused by it.
Oh, let's not go there. Let's not go there. Yes. All right, folks. Thank you all very much. We'll catch up with you soon. Everybody have happy holidays. The Lambcast will be back in the new year. All right.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Oh, no. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Oh, no. Sheep go to heaven. Goats go to hell.
It's over!